are listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. I'm Georgia.
And I'm Hannah.
And you're listening to Film Picnic. We begin, as always, by acknowledging that Film Picnic is recorded on the ancestral lands of the Musqueam peoples. This land is referred to as unceded territory, as it was not given up freely, and it continues to be home for the indigenous communities from which it was and is stolen.
It is with immense privilege that we talk into these microphones and share our stories, as stories have been shared for generations before us on this land. We hope that Film Picnic can be a space for shared accountability, knowledge sharing, and reconciliation. This always was and always will be Indigenous land.
Beautiful. On that note also, so many great Indigenous films coming out in BC lately.
Yeah.
I'm feeling very stoked on
that. Yeah, me too.
Do you want to introduce our guest?
Yes! So exciting! Today we are joined by a remarkable filmmaker who built an impressive career as an actor, writer, director, and producer. Starting from the ground up as a producer and director's assistant, she worked her way through the ranks of some of the biggest names in entertainment, Netflix, Lionsgate, NBC, and Disney, before transforming her behind-the-scenes experience into a flourishing creative career in her own right. As a director, she's been incredibly prolific, helming 7 short films over the past 6 years, Pringle Mingle in 2024, With The Time in 2025, Little Miss Sleepy also in 2024, and Overtime in 2023, which earned her a nomination for the prestigious One to Watch award by the Vancouver Films Critics Circle.
Her commitment to continuous learning and growth is evident through her participation in UBC's BFA film production program.
Shout out.
Also the VIF Catalyst program, GEMS TV Producer Lab, and Women in the Director's Chair Story and Leadership program, which seems to be a common theme among our guests.
Yeah.
Beautiful. She's passionate about creating female-centric and Asian-Canadian stories that are often overlooked by mainstream media, bringing authenticity and meaning to every project. She represents the new generation of filmmakers who understand every aspect of the creative process and use their platform to tell stories that matter.
Yeah.
Welcome to the picnic, Jenny Lee Gilmore.
Yay! Thanks for having me. That was such a lovely bio introduction. I didn't realize I did that many shorts.
You've been busy.
Yeah. You've been doing things.
We're so excited to have you on. In April of 2024, when Georgia and I first started scheming about Film Picnic, you were one of the first names that came up in wanting to have you on and talk.
This is true. You're on the original list.
Yeah, on the original list
of guests.
Yeah, because, I mean, the first acting job I ever did, that's where I met you.
Oh my goodness.
The commercial that we did.
We did. And we had to hug. That was the whole scene.
Yes.
We had to hug like
what
over and over again.
What was this commercial for?
Was it like kind of like a workday vibe? It wasn't workday.
Like a platform?
Yeah, it was like
software
a platform. Yeah,
something?
For like companies or like shot something. I don't know. Yeah. I was buying a pair of shoes from Jenny.
Yes, I was selling shoes.
You're hugging the shoe sales?
Yeah, because I was so excited that she had
I did such a good job of selling the shoes that she hugs me.
All right.
But knowing that you started at UBC coming from film production and your journey there, I think it's very valuable for our listeners to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And certainly just, like even doing research and reading through all the different kind of avenues that you've taken, I think it's really exciting to know that a UBC BFA film graduate is flourishing, thriving. Not that they don't, but just
have they ever had you
inspiring.
Back to talk?
No, I'm still waiting.
I'm actually really surprised.
Invite. Yeah, I think that's, I think in general, the program, there are so many incredible alumni ahead of me, too. And they kind of don't come back. I'm not sure why. Maybe there isn't a system built to bring them back. So
well,
it's amazing
actually,
that you
was
guys
there not
are.
A conversation about
so
an alumni network
104.
Being
yeah.
built?
They're trying to develop a stronger system for UBC film production alumni.
That's amazing.
I'm just so surprised because I feel like we've had a lot of people come in who do more commercial work or maybe like stuff that maybe people in the program are less initially inclined to like want to be doing. So I feel like, Women in the Director's Chair, VIF, all of the things that you've done would be. Yeah.
And I mean, we have lots of questions about those, but I think too, it feels very valuable just knowing, like even shout out Nushi, who did the VIF Catalyst program, but it's like those, I think programs specifically can be those kind of next steps and, helping yourself feel oriented after like the graduation, like nebulous. Yeah, ooh, sorry. Thank you. No, no, it's all good.
Yeah.
Hair, makeup. It's just Aiden. Thank Aiden you. Goes, no. Yeah, let's start with a question.
Yeah.
You wear so many different hats. You've tried so many different, as many film professionals do, you're actor, writer, director, producer. How do you balance these different roles? Do you find that they inform each other in the creative process? Is there one that you prefer most?
Great questions.
multiple questions.
How I balance them, I feel like, one, it depends what I get booked on. Mm-hmm. So say for acting, if there's a really busy period, I'll put that kind of at the forefront. For me, for acting, it's taken a backseat recently, I would say. Mainly just because for me it's been so slow, so I focus more on my writing and directing, and then assistant work, which has become so busy. So if I'm working, say, on a TV show as an assistant, I will not audition during that time period unless it's something really big.
Which is fair, because yes. You can't really be like, actually, I'm gonna leave for a few weeks.
Yes, yeah. Which I did do my first ever assistant job. I was like, this is right out of school in 2019. I worked as a producer assistant, and I told them, I was like, I never book anything. It's fine. Like, it won't be an issue. And within the 6 months of that show, I booked like 7 jobs. So like,
that's
I had
always like, how it happens.
Yeah, I was like, I have to. Can I leave today? They were very nice about it. They did let me leave. But in terms of how they inform each other, I've always wanted to do all of them.
Same.
And I was gonna say, I feel like you're the same. It's like there isn't one that's a favorite. I think there's pros and cons to all. Like, I feel acting, I love so much because you're kind of trusted with one thing. You're trusted with the character.
I love acting.
You just show up. Yeah, you don't have to really worry about anything else except yourself.
Yes.
And you just have to be prepared.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. I feel it's a little less stressful, but there's also more pressure of like, you do have to show up in a certain way, and there's pressure in that.
Yeah, people are looking at you and watching how you behave on
perceived
set. You were very much being perceived.
Definitely. And then writing and directing, I love that because there's so much more control and collaboration in that sense, and I find you're creating the story, so you don't have to wait for someone else to give you a role that you like or that you connect with. There's just a lot more creative control and collaboration with other people. But both are, you're always waiting kind of for funding or auditions. There's still a lot of, so I just, whatever's like happening, I'll just follow that train.
Yeah, I feel like people always, I had a director yesterday be like, Hannah, if you ever just commit to one thing, you're gonna be so successful at that one thing. And I was like, ooh. It was a compliment. It was nice. Yeah. He meant it in a nice way.
Okay.
But I just like really am cognizant of kind of the, I mean, even guests we've had, they kind of say you gotta choose one, which I don't really feel inclined to choose one. I kind of want to do it all. Does it feel overwhelming to you at any point? Like, do you ever go, oh, I wish I was just doing...
I understand that advice because I think you don't want to spread yourself too thin where you can't really give your all to anything. But in terms of this industry, I feel like it's so helpful. Like, I'm sure you find this. Like, maybe your first time on a big set, it's like, you know what you're doing. You know what, like, what sound speeding means because you, like, knew that. I feel like my first ever commercial I didn't even know, like... They're like, sound speeding. I was like, do I go yet? Like, I didn't even know where to go or what a mark was. So having that, like, behind the scenes experience is super helpful. But yeah, I do believe in, like, you want to give your all to something. Sometimes it's really hard to do that when you wear so many hats. But in this industry, I find that it's very common for people to do a lot more than one thing. And that's usually, like, it's helpful to do more than one thing.
Yeah.
I think that was another thing that's come up with some of our other guests is... You know, if the acting is slow, take initiative to write your own part. Take initiative to, you know, create opportunities for yourself, even when, you know, if it's not happening in one area, make it happen for yourself in another area.
Lots
of value in that.
I'm really curious to know about your experience coming out of a film production program. Because I feel like, and you know, your opinion can be great or it can be, but I just feel like, you know, some people are like, film school, what's the point? Others say it's great. I know it really depends on who you are and how you take it, but I'm curious what your journey has been like throughout film school. Did you get into the industry while you were in school, and like, what has that transition been like?
Yeah, so when I came to UBC in 2015, you had to apply to the film program once you'd done a general year of art. So you couldn't apply right out of high school. So I knew when I came to UBC, that was the goal, is I wanted to apply after first year. But I never made a film. I'd like never been on set. I just knew I wanted to make films. So my first ever film I made was for the application for UBC film. Yeah. Mm. And that's like a little, like you get people in your, I don't know if you had this, like people who have been making films since they were like 12 in high school. So there's like a big difference in terms of experience. But yeah, I knew I wanted to go into the industry, and I really liked the program for because it was so small, like 20 people
it
each
was
year.
13 in my cohort when we graduated. Oh my God, that's we started at 18.
Tiny. Oh no.
We started at 8. I think it was just like COVID and you know.
Mm. Yeah, people
also
find it's not
one
for
of our
them.
Profs was like, or Antoine was like, you know, not we were like, why do people keep leaving? And he was like, not everyone is crazy like you guys. Not everyone wants to be on set 35 hours every weekend.
True.
And we were like, yeah, good point.
Yes, it's not for everyone.
Yes.
But I think like it's true, like you don't have to go to film school to work in film, and that's like constantly a thing I hear on set on union shows, and I'm an assistant.
I'm like, I went to film school.
Yeah, you're like, okay, I'm a BFA. It's true, you don't, but I think there's a big difference between working like in the industry as a technician and being like a writer director. That's a craft that you have to learn. Whether that's through like a traditional degree or something else, I do think that's something you have to put time into. So I liked that aspect of the film production program, and I loved how I'm like, I'm still friends and I work with a lot of the people I went to school with. So Studio 104, who produced all my projects, Mike Johnston, he was two years above me in the film program. So I one of the first sets I was on was one of his shorts. So it's really good for that because it's small. It's
the
not. The connections. Yeah. I also like I didn't really know what I wanted to do in film. Like I really liked writing. I didn't really know what a director did.
Yeah. And you like producing, I was like, I don't really know what that is, but I want to do it.
It's like, so that's good, right? You can try all the things. Yeah. I knew I didn't want to do camera. That was the only thing. I was like, I don't want to touch
that. I thought I
did.
I don't.
You're right. I feel like I'm starting to lean that way.
Yeah, I just, my back. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just, it's my back.
Save your back. It's for, health reasons.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we do a second year, and then in third year, you six people get selected to make their short film. And I really wanted to write and direct one, and we'd all pitch.
Yeah,
I didn't get selected, and I was like, I'm going to spend a whole year like not doing the thing I want to do. And I produced instead. We did a film called It's a Boy, Kay Dow directed. And that was amazing because she really knew what she was doing. So as a producer, I got to watch and learn from her. And then the producing is great because you learn all the other skills.
Yeah.
And then fourth year, I wrote and directed Breakaway, which was my first short film. Thanks.
Truly.
Yes.
Truly.
Yes.
What was the thing that it was?
Yeah. It was selected for CBC Short Film Face-Off's Top 9. Like, can you talk a little bit about that experience or like how that maybe catapulted you forward?
So this short film Face-Off is, it's kind of like rounds of like each week there's three short films, and then you they play them, and then people, there's a jury that vote for kind of a winner. This happened during COVID time, so like usually you would go to a studio and like film in person and they would play your film and ask you questions. So we did it all over Zoom. And the funny thing is we pre-recorded like winning speeches. I didn't win.
That's heartbreaking.
So
that's
this video somewhere, me being like, thank you.
No, I love that though.
So much. But it was great just to, one, like connect with the CBC people. Mm-hmm. And then to be able to direct people, the CBC Gem, to watch my film and just kind of,
I guess credibility to be like,
exactly.
My film is on this platform. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to get eyes on the film is great. But anyone can apply. You just apply online. You just submit your film.
That's good to know. I produced in my third year as well. Mm-hmm. I was more I did like a really personal script, and then I was like, I don't want to make this right now. So I produced instead, and I loved it. And then I produced and directed in my fourth year, but editing, I'm like in the before like sound and color grading, and I find that final part of it hard,
because
it's like, it's a heartbreaking process making a film. Like I'm so happy with how it looks, but at the same time I don't know. I think we're all
But there's, I mean, there's so many different versions of how it could look. I feel like that's I have encountered with like writing something and shooting something and editing it, because I was like, I'm gonna do it all myself. I have this idea and I'm gonna just try and like, I'm gonna use it as an opportunity to try out every little role.
Yeah.
Because I'm in film studies, not film production, which also is interesting to be on sets, and people be like, film school, and I'm like, oh yes, film school, but it's academia. It's not even like, it's not even like, this is how to write a script. It's like, this is film theory. Anyways, that aside.
Before you just ask another question, because it's going to be great, I just want to circle back to what you were saying about film school versus not film school. And I think I totally agree with what you're saying. I think film school honestly just gives you the space to like think about what you might want to do and understand what the industry is like, and two, how you might want to fit in. Because I feel like everybody is different, and it totally depends on how you take it. But it might be easier to say, be interested in lighting initially and spend however many years going into like the union that way, and then want to shift. And that's like one thing at a time. But then obviously you can go and do your indie stuff on your own as well. But I liked film school, personally.
I think you said it so well. It just gives you the space to create. And if it's really bad, no one's going to care, because no one's going to watch. Yeah. Unless you submit to CBC short film face-off. But it gives you the space. And I do find a lot of people in the union, they work their way up through the AD department or lighting if they want to be a cinematographer. But they end up working for like a decade and never actually like made anything.
Yeah.
So film school is great because they give you the resources, like crew, the volunteers and equipment. And that is pretty great.
Yeah.
Have you found it difficult to pivot from one thing to another, like just, you know, as we're talking about like, oh, trying one thing and then maybe moving to another, like has that felt like a pretty seamless transition to you?
I've never found it, I'd say, tricky to kind of pivot. I think, well, I'll say like when I first left film school, I thought I wanted to be in the art department because I thought I was going to be unemployed otherwise. Like I was like, I need to find something that like I can work in.
They pushed sound on us for that.
Like, oh, really? Yeah,
you get paid well if you do sound.
You do. We need more sound people. That is very true. But I think I've always just like followed my heart. So it hasn't been like necessarily like tricky. Beautiful. Yeah. I'm just like whatever I really, even like I did a couple like production design, like art direction, worked in the art department on indie stuff. And I loved those projects and I loved the people that were doing it. So watching even those directors and producers working, I was like, great, I can use this for my work. And now I'm realizing I don't want to be in the art department. I want to be doing that.
Yeah. But now you know how to direct the art department.
Exactly.
Now I know how in a way that allows them to do what they need to do well. Yeah.
With your kind of trajectory from assistant to filmmaker, can you talk a little bit about your experiences working with, you know, obviously we're talking about film school, but like bigger Netflix, Lionsgate, NBC, Disney, like what was the most valuable takeaways from those experiences?
Yeah. So I'll say it's funny. I haven't transitioned out of assisting. I still do that. I'm doing another assistant job at the end of this month. So I go back and forth. That's how I like split my time, is one, like I consider it my day job of like, I need to make money. This is more consistent. So I'll do like 6 months on a show. Then after that, I'll like find funding for my short film and then I'll go make that and then kind of balance the two. But right out of film school, I was a producer's assistant on a Netflix show called Julie and the Phantoms. And that's probably the biggest jump and learning curve I've had from film school, because I'd never been on a set that big. And a show runs so differently from like a short film.
A student short film, for that
even
matter.
Just getting the call sheet for the first day of shooting, I was like, holy cow. No, truly, you're like flipping it. You've seen that. Yes. There's just like... Like, how are this many people in one set?
Yeah.
And what is a Jenny op? And like, who, what is like, how are they, what is a special? Like, I just didn't know any of like the larger crew and how it worked. So that was really amazing that I got that experience. And even just in the office of like how people interact and the hierarchies of like working on a show of like the network and the studio, and they're in charge. But really like this showrunner is also in charge, but it has to go through this person. Yeah. It was like the politics of a show that really... was a steep learning curve for me. But the assistant's jobs, yeah, I still do. Now I know I only do director assistant positions.
No,
that's
more producers assistant.
No, I think I realize I don't want to be a producer. Like, I just, I do it my, like, for my own projects, because you kind of have to.
Yeah.
I don't do the day to day. Like, my producing partner does mainly that. But I just realized the meetings in a producer assistant job, it's like logistics and budget and all this stuff. And I wanted to be like in the creative meetings with the director.
What kind of, because my brain is very much like producer's brain. I'm like, yes, budgets.
Yes.
What does it look like to be a director's assistant? Like, obviously it's a different role to AD.
Yeah, I get this question so much because people don't really understand what it is. So it's, you assist one person, that is the director, that's the person you answer to, but you're also technically hired by production, so you also answer to the production manager of, like, you're the one that's keeping the director happy. So at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, I'm still servicing the production. But it really depends on who you get as a director. It can be personal stuff as well, like if they, you have to book travel for them and their family, like restaurant reservations, things like that. But it's also, you get to sit in every single meeting, so like a tone meeting, casting, get to go to castings, get to watch tapes, you get to like read the script with them and do all the concept meetings. And I've been very lucky that my past two bosses have been more mentors for me, so they've included me in the creative process of like, how would you shoot the scene, and let's build a shot list together sort of thing.
That's an incredible learning.
So creative input, like your creative input is also valued and included.
I've been very lucky to have that, because I don't know if that's always the case.
I mean, I'm assuming you could probably get a director that's like,
I mean, I'm sure you'd have
my laundry on
a bit of a butthole. But but I try and, like, now because I've done so many assistant jobs, like when I go into an interview, I'm very much like, okay, I'm interviewing you as well.
Yes.
And, like,
as it kind of always should be.
Yeah, exactly. Like, do I want to spend 14 hours a day with you? And I found that the directors that ask me about my own work, I'm like, okay, there's a good sign that they're interested in me.
Yeah.
And want that matters. To, like, share. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very quickly on that topic, out of film school, getting that assistant job, what was the connection? Was there a connection?
Yeah, it's actually a UBC connection. So firstly, like, they never advertise assistant jobs.
They don't
put them out into...
You have to... me asking Amanda every few months, I'm like, hey, girl.
Yeah, it's the production managers.
I do not say it like that at all. But
they're the ones you need to hit up. Or the office. Sometimes, like, on the DGC, what's filming, you could definitely do, like, a cold call email. But they're usually the ones that would contact me and be like,
they'll, like, recommend.
Yeah, it's like, once you're in the assistant club, you're in the club forever sort of thing. But the first one I got was actually a UBC theater alumni who no longer does acting. He was now producing, and he was producing the Netflix show, and he contacted Sarah Crotter from UBC. Was like, do you have any, like, graduate, like, people who just graduated that would potentially want to interview for
Love
this job?
So my first year, like, the UBC film program sent, or like Sarah specifically sends just like jobs every whenever she gets them, and I applied to every single one in my
That's
first
amazing.
Year, which is great. Some I got. I was a cinematographer on a feature documentary.
That's incredible.
Never done cinematography before. Anyway, it was fine. It worked out. I learned how to use the camera, but I know. And then some I didn't, but it was just, like, good practice.
Exactly.
Being like, let me pitch myself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience in VIF Catalyst or, you know, GEMS TV Producer Lab, Women in the Director's Chair, maybe how those programs were helpful to you, what you took away from them?
Mm-hmm. So I think the reason I firstly applied to a lot of these programs is when UBC was so great for that cohort building and you get really close with everyone. Mm. And then when you're let out into the industry, it's like just massive. And then I didn't know anyone. So I was like, okay, these programs are really great because they build that cohort again. So the VIF Catalyst, that was amazing because it's partnered with VIF. So you get a pass to go to everything. Everybody in that group, everyone was like in different levels of their career. So some people had done a lot of like funded films. Some people had never really made a film. But that was like amazing to have that different level of experience. And I still keep in contact with a lot of them. The Women in Director's Chair, that's been a really amazing one for me because that cohort and also just alumni of that program are incredible. it's a wonderful organization, and I still they help me a lot.
Shout out.
Yeah, ooh, shout out.
In the director's chair. Most recent guest was also Alex Caulfield was also a participant.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, they do a lot of different programs. The Story and Leadership, that's partnered with Whistler. So you get to go up to Whistler to the festival and meet a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's a really, really fun fest. Have you guys been?
Yeah, we
have.
Went to Whistler.
We did.
That was our first second festival that we attended with Film Picnic.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, I think it was, I don't know. Anyway, it was in there. We did. Year. We were there.
Yeah. So fun. And hopefully this year again.
Yeah, hopefully maybe? This year. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, any program that's with a festival is incredible, because also festivals can be really overwhelming of like,
so overstimulating.
What do I go to? And it's just nice to have like, I'm in this program,
so I'm going to go to these things.
Yeah.
Because that's a structure that's set up for me.
Exactly. Yeah. But they've been great just for the networking.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say like both. I took two projects, and one through the GEMS producer lab that never came to fruition. That was a series that I was developing with CBC actually a few years ago, and that kind of came to a halt. So I'm not really like actively working on that project, but the people I met in that program, we still have a group chat and it's very active. So
nice.
This may be like a silly question, but also just kind of fun to ask. Do you have a preference between TV or film? Does it fluctuate?
I think it fluctuates. I've never worked on a feature film.
Just TV.
Like, I guess a lot of the TV I've done shoots like a feature film. So I don't know if people like.
What about like, for example, your Black Mirror episode?
Yes. So I was going to say that was like a mini feature film.
Hayden's face is like, what? Up.
I love name dropping that. People are like, what have you worked on? And before it was like children's movies, I was like, oh, this Disney Channel movie that you probably haven't watched. But now I'm like, Black Mirror?
You ever heard of it?
Yeah. Hey. Yeah.
The Common People. Awesome.
Yeah, Common People.
Season 2?
Season 7.
Oh my God. 7, episode 1.
It's close.
There's so many seasons.
This is the one with Rashida Jones and Chris O'Dowd. So that was the only one out of that season that shot in Vancouver. So like it was shot like a feature film, and it really felt like a feature film, just like the caliber of what we were making and just like the shoot days.
Yeah.
I just did the Malcolm in the Middle reboot, and that's like 4 episodes, but we shot it like a feature. So that was like another kind of experience of like you prep everything, then you shoot. But in terms of like,
Common People, what were you doing on that? You were in it, but that was additional.
I'm in it for, so yeah, I was the, well, technically I was the assistant to the director and 3 producers.
Damn.
But the 3 producers are from the UK and they were very low maintenance. So
also, that's a great opportunity.
Yes.
Are
amazing.
You interested in working internationally at all?
Well, I was actually born in the UK. I lived in the UK, I actually have a question for you, Hannah, because I moved to Canada when I was 13.
Okay.
I lost my accent, my very English accent. You can hear it in my film over time because I play some home videos in it. And people are always shocked that I sound like this now.
Well, when you're 13.
Yeah, because I know you're from Australia. Yeah. And I feel like I still hear your accent sometimes.
So let me explain my lore.
It does come out.
I grew up in Japan for the first 12 years of my life. And I went to an international school.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom is Australian. And when I was a little kid, I had like, I would say both and like what, banana or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then kids at school would be banana. Like, why are you saying it like that? But then I moved to Australia and my accent became Australian. No one in Australia ever claimed that I had an Australian accent. Mm-hmm. But when I moved here, everyone was like, are you British? Are you Australian? Where are you from? But then after like auditioning for 6 months, my accent went so North American because I could never tell when I sounded like American versus Australian. And so acting really kind of had me clock it.
Like locked it into that. Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah. Because I remember meeting you and I was like, oh, she definitely has an accent. But I feel like even from like since then, I've noticed like your accent has become more North American.
Yeah.
But that's like for me, when everyone is shocked that I grew up in the UK. So I'm a UK citizen. I still go back a lot. My accent comes out when I go.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Well, same when I'm in
Australia, apparently it still comes like on set on Malcolm in the Middle. I said something and literally like 3 crew members turned to me. And they're like, why did you sound so British when you said that? It just like comes out sometimes.
Yeah.
But going back to your question, in terms of, yeah, I would love to work in the UK. I just, it's far.
I would also love to work in the UK.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know anyone. Well, now I do, I guess, these three producers. But it's just, I feel like it's such a different system that I haven't, I'd have to really kind of uproot and go.
I hear that again. The culture of the industry is more European in that, like, the regular, like, for example,
working actors, hours,
10-hour days.
10-hour days. Yes. Actors can only get a maximum of 4 slides, 4 like pieces of paper for their audition. You can't have more than 4 pages.
Oh yeah. Wow.
And they have to get at least like 48 hours or something.
We love that.
Which is like not the same.
No. Yeah. And that was one good thing about Black Mirror, is because the producers were from England. We never went over our 12s, I don't think. Rarely. They kind of kept it. And like at like 6 p.m. they were just like, well, time to go home. And I've never had that. Yeah, I've like, sometimes been in the office until like 9, 10 p.m. in prep. And so
I mean, that's the industry that we're in. But I'm
I was a director assistant to Ali Pankhiu, who is an incredible Canadian director who's worked in both TV and narrative. And it was like incredible to work for her, because she's only, I think she's maybe 10 years older than me. So to work for someone who's doing so well and is kind of, it feels very in reach. And she's so kind and like sharing her knowledge and experience.
And this was for Black Mirror?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And wanting to uplift like younger, like BIPOC and female creatives. So that was a really, really fun job.
Yeah.
That's awesome. That's so funny. Oh,
no, you go.
Well, I was just going to say, it's so funny. I, in doing research, I found this moment where you said that you felt othered growing up in small English villages. Mm-hmm. And then it just naturally came up in the conversation. How do those experiences impact the way that you're telling stories now? Or, you know, because personal identity seems to be a central theme in a lot of your own shorts and those kinds of things. Like, have you... It's an obvious influence, and maybe like, how do you approach weaving your personal identity into your work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I grew up in a very rural area in England. So my mom is Chinese, my dad is English, so my brother and I, being mixed, we were like maybe one of 5 kids in the whole of our school that weren't white. So that was like a very, like, that was like the first thing that would always come up when people met me. They'd be like, where are you from? Yeah, like, are you Chinese? Like, it was just, like, so hard for them to compute that my brother and I were, like, born there. And it was just, like, a very, like, odd experience. I'm sure you found this. Of just, like, feeling different always. And that was just, like, the common feeling. And that's also why we left.
From here.
Yeah, exactly. Just, like, just assuming.
Yeah.
But I think my mom was like, we have to leave. She's like, I don't want to be here anymore. Because she's from Vancouver. So we moved. But yeah, I think a lot of my work is about identity and feeling not like confident in my identity growing up. And that's such a formative age as well, of like up until 13. And it was just a very different, like when I came to Canada, meeting mixed people for the first time, like I never really met anyone else that was like mixed Asian. And I think I wrote about it in my UBC application, I think, actually. But like... I do remember, like, Googling other mixed race people, because I, like, didn't know they existed. This was, like, pre-social media, pre-kind of, like, main internet sort of thing. And in terms of, like, movies, I never saw, like, any Asian people. And the first film I ever watched that had, like, an Asian face in was The Princess Diaries.
Love.
Wow. Principal Gupta. Love. Yes. Sandra Oh, still one of my favorite people and actors.
Yes.
But I think I was like 4 years old, and that was like the first time I saw someone like really other than my mom who was like Asian. So I remember that having a big impact.
Mm-hmm.
I did actually work with her.
I was going to say, you said she's one of the most amazing people. I was like, okay, we're just going to circle back on that.
Yeah. Tell this story. I don't think I've ever told this story. Well, I've told this to everyone like all my friends.
Yeah.
I'm listening. We're listening. We're engrossed.
We're sad.
Okay. Actually, well, this was actually my first real job out of film school. I was a craft services PA on an Air Canada commercial. And my friend from the UBC program, Andy Alvarez, was, I think she was working in the office.
Yeah.
And she knew I was a huge fan of like Sandra Oh, and she didn't want to say anything until like I got the job and was on set. Mm-hmm. But she like called me the day before, and she was like, don't freak out, but Sandra Oh is like the star of this commercial. It did freak out. And then, yeah, we were filming in the airport, so I was just like bringing like sandwiches around. I think like the first time I like brought her a vegetable tray, my hands were like shaking, and you could see the little like tomatoes. That was so. I don't know if she's gonna be nice. Very starstruck. She was lovely. I wrote her a letter, which you're not really supposed to do as a PA. Don't do this. I wrote her a letter.
I would find that really sweet.
Yeah, I like had this letter and I didn't know how to give it to her. And luckily, like Andy and then Kayla Wachell was the B cam operator and already knew Sandra. So we all got a picture together. Aww. And I gave her the letter. And then the next day when we wrapped, she said, "Where's Jenny?" And she looked around, she came up to me and she goes, "Jenny, I read your letter." And then she hugged me. And then I burst into tears and then I kind of blacked out. So I don't remember the advice she gave me. It was something about mountains and looking out at the mountains from like her house because her parents live here. Mm-hmm. And then just something about representation because I'd written this letter and then I have a photo with her where I'm just like sobbing.
That's
my story. And hopefully one day work with her again.
Yeah, like, I'm sure you will.
I'll never watch Grey's Anatomy in the same way.
I love it.
I'll be forever changed.
She was my favorite character on Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah, same. Like, our person.
Yeah, she's just amazing. So maybe one day I'll get to direct her in something. That would be like a dream.
Awesome.
Dream come true. So
I think that's a lovely place to take a quick
five.
I'm on a high. Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. We'll come right back.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at MasseyBooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read. Are you looking to decolonize your self-care routine? Take a trip down to Sisters Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sister Sage is an award-winning local Indigenous business run by Tsimshian entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sister Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there.
Picture this. You're walking into your local record store and start skimming the many records until you find an album that you recognize. You pick out the album, check the track list, and maybe only recognize a couple songs. Now you have to listen to the whole album, right? Well, why not do it together? On Discali, every show runs you through an entire album and breaks down key parts and songs that make up an album's aesthetic, art, and story. I'm your host, Oliver, and join me every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. in talking about all things music. Want to discover more albums, artists, record pressings, and concerts? I got you. That's every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., so tune in to Discali to discover different discographies and add to the musical discourse.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre, the SASC, is a free and confidential service which provides support to those who experience sexual assault, intimate partner violence, and harassment. We provide services to folks of all genders, including students, staff, faculty, and those who have a connection to the UBC Vancouver campus. We provide crisis and short-term emotional support, legal, medical, and campus-related advocacy, and outreach and educational programs. We are located in the Student Nest, room 3130. For more information on our hours of operation and other resources and services, please go to our website, amssasc.ca, or visit our Facebook page, AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. I'm Hannah.
And I'm Georgia.
And you're listening to Film Picnic.
We have a very special guest here, Jenny Lee Gilmore, filmmaker, writer, assistant, BFA human. Graduate.
Yes.
Sandra Oh fan.
Yes.
All of the things.
Should we get into talking about some of your specific films that you've done? I had the joy of watching Little Miss Sleepy yesterday. Okay. And oh my God, I literally got chills. I teared up at certain points. It was just so, I feel like such an important story to tell. If you want to maybe give a quick synopsis or log line about.
Yeah. So Little Miss Sleepy, it's a CBC short doc about my diagnosis with type 1 narcolepsy, and currently there isn't a known cure or cause of narcolepsy. So in the film, I go to Montreal and volunteer for my brain to be studied by some scientists and maybe hopefully one day find more out about narcolepsy. Mm. Yes, a very personal film. I directed it and I was also the subject, so that was a very interesting dynamic of having to be so vulnerable on camera and wanting to like push myself to these vulnerable places. Yeah. But also being like, oh my gosh,
cut.
Exactly. That's yeah, what that's, I'm like,
we need to do it again.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really proud of the film. I'll start with maybe so what narcolepsy is. So narcolepsy basically means your brain can't control your sleep and wake cycles, so we don't have like a stage 1, 2, 3 sleep and then REM. So we can fall asleep into REM sleep very quickly, like within a couple minutes. Or at night, we just don't stay in REM, so we just wake up a lot. Mm-hmm. So for me, that looks like I'm often quite tired, or if I like lie down, I'll fall asleep very quickly. Mm. And I really wanted to make the film, one, because I feel like most people don't know what it is. Two, it's way more common than people think. A lot more people have it than they realize.
And
three, it's like people have really big misconceptions of what narcolepsy is because of like Hollywood movies.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. Like you mentioned in the film some of the outlandish things that people would say to you when they found out that you had narcolepsy. But I feel like, the way that it's been portrayed in the media is maybe kind of like, oh, you just fall asleep.
Exactly. Like it's often used as like a butt of a joke, which I find like humor in the situation. There are a lot of like funny things with narcolepsy, but often like in films, it's people falling asleep instantly, like while they're standing up, while they're talking, while they're eating. And maybe that's the case in some like very, very extreme cases. But for the majority of people with narcolepsy, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
Mm. And then people think that's the only way it presents. So when I was first diagnosed, I was like, well, I feel like what I know about narcolepsy, that's not what I know. Like, I feel like I'm not those people.
Yeah.
And I also watched a documentary about narcolepsy that the BBC did like a very long time ago. And it was just so dated. And like the people who had narcolepsy were like really old and usually men.
Can I also say,
were
anything,
they white as well?
Yes.
anything on the BBC feels dated to me because I think that's like the original, like what I think of as documentary style with like that like British narrator voice. I'm like, even if it's on contemporary material, I'm kind of like, this is olden time. I don't know.
I love the BBC, but it's just a very like, it's out of date thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was diagnosed during my last week of exams in fourth year at the UBC. I don't know if it exists anymore. Like there's a sleep clinic here.
I think there is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember like I lived off campus and then I got a call. They're like, someone didn't show up to their sleep study. Can you get here within an hour? Because there's a super long wait list. So I was waiting for so long. And I was like, okay, I'll come. Came and did the overnight sleep study. And I remember leaving the next morning on the 99 where they glue all these like electrodes to your head. And you can't shower there. So I was on the 99 with this like glue in my hair. And I was like, please.
They took the electrodes off.
Yeah, they took the electrodes off. They just left all the glue. I was like, please, no one see me from my classes. I was like, this is so embarrassing. But yeah, I was diagnosed after that. And that was pretty life-changing and like validating. Like I would fall asleep on set all the time, like, you know, when you're like waiting and I'm just like
feeling. I don't have narcolepsy at all, and I find it
a risk
challenging
anyway.
Yes.
to stay awake on set
regardless. And I think that's the thing in film. It's like everyone is sleep deprived and overworked. So everyone is kind of exhausted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's also another reason why I wasn't. I always felt like it was something more than just that. But it's hard to pinpoint when you work in an industry that kind of, you know, wears you down.
Yeah. And kind of also like praises you for being in that state of like.
Yeah.
Being overworked and
it's like
out,
a badge like, of honor of yeah, like, I only slept 4 hours last night.
Like, okay, it's like, okay. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a lot of people, I slept for 1 hour and I'm like,
you're going to die at 50.
Like, that's, yeah. Well, that literally when, because you know how to, you.
No, it's okay.
Sorry, what?
No, it's okay.
I'm having trouble with my speech these days. You know how we have to do that MPIO certification yes. as a part of our degree? Mm-hmm. I remember the person that came in. Drilled into my brain. First year, she goes, the life expectancy for someone in the industry is 47. And I was like, but that's because, you know, there's many different, you know, drugs yeah. and whatever else on set. And but like, that was something that was just
right.
like,
there, I remember that. Our burnout episode, we did research it. And there was like a statistics sheet about life expectancies for different areas in different departments in film. And I think it was
grip
like,
was not good.
Grip yeah. was not good. It was like transit was also.
Oh, that's how you're sitting all day.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty.
I feel like ADs, maybe yeah. stress.
Yeah. yeah. It was like anyway. 47. Anyways.
Yeah, that's really wild. But that's what's great about like our generation is we're changing some of those like work habits. Agree. Yeah, industry standards yeah. so we can live longer than 47.
Yes. Yeah. Have you, I mean, what year did you make Little Miss Sleepy? Was
that was 2024. Okay. Well, it's kind of I'll talk about maybe like how we got that yeah, made because yeah. it was kind of during COVID I found this sleep research study they were doing in Montreal and I wanted to go, but I was also like, if I'm gonna go, I really want to make a film of this. And then it got postponed because no one could travel because of COVID. So that got pushed. And then in 2023, they invited me to come and I could film it, but I had no money to make the film. Like, I hadn't pitched it anywhere. So I partnered with Mike Johnston from Studio 104 and we just self-financed that first kind of bit of like, we didn't shoot on proper cameras. We just took some like little.
They looked really little good. Things.
Yeah, it looked really good.
Yeah. I was like, wow.
Yeah, Kate Smith, who I went to UBC with, shot it. And then Dita Sue Bilgin, who I also went to UBC with, came and did like B-cam sound production managing. She's in the film. So it was just like us three. Wow. It really felt like a student film project. And then after that we contacted CBC Short Docs and kind of pitched it. I'm like, we have some footage already, and then they gave us some money to like help develop it and then continue on with the project.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so 2024 I think is when it was finished.
Has that film shifted the way that you interact with the industry and your experience with narcolepsy at all? Because I remember in the film you kind of talked about how you didn't really tell people on set, you didn't really mention
it. That's such a great question. Like initially I'd be really nervous for people to know, especially when I went out for these assistant jobs, like I wouldn't tell them. And then once I got the job I'd be like, hey, so we're doing an overnight and like we're shooting out in Maple Ridge, like is there any way I can leave now? And like just like little things like that. But I was really nervous. I didn't want people to like not hire me because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Legally you're not allowed to do that, but of course like you still would. So I was always very nervous to tell people. And then since I've made the film I feel so much more open about talking about it. One, because when you Google me I'm now like the face of narcolepsy. So like I can't really avoid it. But two, it's just like it's been really refreshing, like the reactions. I think I've always been scared that people would, not hire me, not want to work with me. And it's actually been the opposite, where I've had my most recent boss, Malcolm in the Middle, actually came to watch the film in a festival setting. And I was like, oh, I don't know if you should come. Because like, I hadn't told him about my narcolepsy. Mm. But then he would always like check in with me every day and be like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? And like that kind of stuff. So it's actually been very refreshing that people have been accommodating.
Yeah. And I hope that, like you mentioned, our generation, at least our circles, but I like the way, I guess, our perspective on care for each other.
Yes.
In work settings.
I feel like it's moving in a positive direction.
I think so.
I think so.
But I'm also, fresh out of film school, so we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's changing. I mean, like how it looks for me. Like ideally when I'm a director on set, I would hope that we could just do like 10 hour days instead of like a 12 and a half.
When I'm producing, I will like, I mean, we call like 12 hours is pretty standard for student, but I will like, your foot is off the lot at 12 hours.
Yeah,
like, we're not, exactly. We're not pushing that, especially
when it's hard because that means you shoot more days often and that's money maybe you don't have. Yeah. But I mean, the last short film I just shot in the fall last year, that was like, we only had 2 days to shoot it. And I was like, oh, we're trying to do 10-hour days. But at the end of the day, it's like we want to care for the crew, especially if they're volunteering. Mm-hmm. So let's change a scene and make it less shots.
Yeah.
I was very excited, too, I think, when I was doing research and just discovering that film you'd made. I feel compelled to mention this because it was like a big part of my childhood. I had a very influential teacher in my life who left halfway through the year because she had narcolepsy. And she, but it was an instance where she had like... she collapsed and then she was like wheelchair bound and it was very significant and the class raised a bunch of money for her and her family and it was really beautiful. But I guess all of that to say, I was like, oh my gosh, like already feel connected and I'm like so excited to talk to you. But I also just a compliment to you. I think it's really, I think it's brave and inspiring to just see someone wearing their identity on their sleeve, which, you know, I mean, I think also we exist in a artistic culture now where that's happening more often. And, you know, like, you know, we have GEMS and there's like the Vancouver Asian Film Festival. Mm-hmm. And like there's a lot of different avenues for people to explore their identity through film. But it, yeah, it's just inspiring to see somebody, you know, like you said, I mean, kind of scary being like, OK, well, maybe my boss is going to come see this. But it's a story that I want to tell and like not letting those fears or thoughts about like how you're going to be perceived inhibit you.
I really appreciate that. And what I've also found with Little Miss Sleepy is like a lot of people have connected to the film. They may not have narcolepsy, but everyone has maybe something that they're struggling with. And just trying to make film a more accessible space in general and a more healthy space is
accessible,
I think, really keyword. Important. Yeah.
Yeah.
And healthy, both keywords. Yes.
Yes. Can we talk a little bit about going, you know, along this theme of like personal identity, female-centric stories, Asian-Canadian stories, how have you connected with those communities in Vancouver and how has that manifested in your filmmaking?
I think like nearly all of my films have centered around something to do with like Asian identity or
like your mom.
My Overtime. Mom in my documentary Overtime, a lot of that is about being like an Asian woman who loves hockey and plays hockey. I think like that my Asian heritage is something I only started to connect with when I was a teenager and like to feel really proud about. And in Vancouver there's so many incredible like Asian filmmakers and networks, like VAF is amazing.
Ma'am.
And Ma'am,
that's happening
this year. I guess
Mila Zuo,
she was a
beautiful.
What was she, what did she do with Ma'am?
I think she's been a programmer and or a judge. I could be wrong. I need to double check that. I know she's definitely worked with VAF. Okay. But I'm just a fan of her generally. Sorry.
No, their VAF is incredible. I'm Little Miss Sleepy like screened there, and so did Overtime, and they just do a really good job of not only like programming films, but building that network of like raising filmmakers up and connecting them with each other. Because if you can't screen your films places or get mentorship or just like guidance, there's not really a way for you to elevate and grow. And I think that's been a really beautiful thing that they've done.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, Vancouver, it's a great place for film. It's I was going to say it's small. It is small. And I think in a space where there is so much and so little going on at the same time, I don't know how to describe that. I just think there's so much interest, and to build community, it's so important. And like I think that's kind of been a through line of what we've been saying, like with film school and with the Catalyst programs and with festivals and all of that. It is solidifying a sense of community. And
Do you I guess like do you because I know you're assisting, you're about to begin assisting on another show, but maybe in the back of your mind, do you already have ideas for your next short film? Do you have ideas like something that you haven't used that you want to use?
Ooh, good question.
And please share them with our audience.
Yeah.
I always
What's cooking?
Have, ideas. Actually, I want to just really quickly before I go into that is like being an assistant's really interesting because I'm often like the only firstly like woman in the room, like when I'm in these meetings of like head of department.
That's really insane.
And then like the only like Asian person in the room.
Bonus question, is that in Netflix, Lionsgate, big studios? Is that small scale, both?
That's the big scale.
Okay.
That's like who is in charge. It's still not diverse.
At all. I sent a very kind of same note, but I was looking up like top studios in Australia and what they're doing. And like the largest, not soundstage, but you know how they have... Well, the largest lot in Australia, they have like a photo of all of their team, and I was like okay, love you guys, everyone here is above the age of 50 and that's fine, but you're also all white, also well it was just like, oh,
and two women,
and yes and I was like okay.
Yeah, it's pretty noted. Wild. It's like who has the power to make decisions like creatively
also
and like
to
financially
make a change in that system.
Yeah, and I wish like I think a couple of my bosses have done really well and like they're equally as invested in making the industry more diverse, but it really has to come from people who aren't just BIPOC as well, like making these changes.
Yeah.
But that was definitely another like a learning curve of like stepping on my first union set being like, oh, this is not like film school. It's like, I'm going to be called that Asian girl's name. We're going to get mixed up for the rest of the show.
Yeah. I feel very lucky. Like I'm a producer's assistant at a documentary production company.
Lantern.
I work at Lantern.
Very cool.
And I love it.
Yeah.
And it's all women. Yeah. And I'm like, this is great.
It's amazing. Changes the vibe.
It really changes the vibe.
Yeah.
As our last guest said, just the more diversity of just people you have on set, people are just generally on better behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Love to see it.
Yeah.
Definitely.
What you're cooking up?
Back to my question.
I thought you were genuinely asking about cooking.
What are you having for dinner?
What's next?
What's the barbecue service?
That would be a hilarious. That would be a hilarious picnic question.
What did you have for dinner last night?
So funny.
This is journalism.
Yeah.
I don't even remember. So what I'm cooking up? I have a short film that's going to do its festival run this fall with Time.
Congratulations,
Rachel Chen shot.
Shout out Rachel.
Should
have Rachel on.
You should. She's great. She does union and indie, so I think that's a good perspective as well. But in terms of things that are in development, I have a feature film Dormant, which I'm writing and trying to get funding for. And that will hopefully be my first feature. And it's the first time I've really written a feature by myself. And that has been an interesting process. I'd co-written a feature before with my friend, but this is the first one I've done by myself, and I'm at the point where it's really hard, so I'm just not doing it sort of thing.
I have a feature nooked away. It's just in my brain right now. It's nowhere else. But
that's like, that's good. Like, keep those ideas in your brain. And like, even like, I have a document where I write down like any project that I have in my mind right now, and some of them are just like log lines or like small ideas, but I just focus on the ones I know I can make in the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
I have a feature, and then hopefully write and direct that. I like to say I want to do that in the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. I would say get funding for that.
Amazing.
And then I'm writing another short film, which is more in the horror land, because I want to try that kind of world. And I've never worked with VFX or special effects, and that's something I want to practice in this short.
Amazing.
So that's what's cooking up for me. I'm always looking for a good like documentary subject as well, because I've tapped out my family and myself. No one else wants to see me cry again in a documentary, because I've done that twice. So if you know anyone, cool.
Fine.
There's
actually someone in my program who I think is really, I'll tell you about them later. They're just very interesting in everything that they're doing. I'm like, damn. That's so cool. And you know who I'm talking about, Aiden. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Can't wait to hear about them.
You're communicating with your eyes right now.
Sorry.
I was like, oh. This has been so beautiful. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Yeah. Final question for our audience. Yes. Do you have any words of wisdom? Is there any piece of advice that someone has given you over the years that you kind of hold with you, or anything that you wish you had known when you were fresh out of film school, or maybe just going into it?
I think it's, everyone is like, there is no one set path or way to to work in the industry.
You and are I think listening I was often to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.